And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Is it possible for an individual to make a change in the world? Some have, through inventions, political action, writing, conquest, even mayhem. Joining us now is journalist and author John Paul Flintoff, and we'll discuss his book, How to Change the World. He joins us from London. Good evening, sir.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you, John Paul. So it seems like a monumental undertaking, but we'll begin with you. Some years ago, you said you had your own experience of wanting to change the world. Tell us about that and what you did.
Okay, thank you. In 2005, I found out, at the heart level, about climate change and resource shortages coming our way. And I was really in a dark place. I thought, my God, all the things that I'd imagined my life might work out to be may need to be rethought. And my immediate instinct was, not only do I have to change what I'm doing, but I've got to get everyone else in the whole world to change the way they lead their lives, to make everything a little bit more local so that you're not wasting so much fuel. For example, flying apples around the world when there are plenty of apples growing here in the UK. And so I started growing food, and then I thought, what can I do next? And I thought I could do something about clothing. And so I started making all my own clothes. And the point was, I wanted, and I'm not a guy who normally makes my own clothes, I wanted to do something that shows it's a bigger issue than just the obvious, and it's also funny and fun. And I didn't want to write a book that was preaching green messages to green people who already know it. I wanted to pull other people in. So I wrote a book that was deliberately sending myself up in my mission to make all of my clothes right down to my underpants.
Wow. Are you still making these clothes?
I still make clothes, yeah. I no longer make wife.
Well, I wear a 17 by 34 shirt, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I would need more precise measurements because I do really, really fitted shirts, but I only make them for myself. I decided that was the best way because if people like what I've done, then they can try doing it themselves. So I moved away from trying to make everyone do things, and I thought, if I do this and people like it, then they can copy. And I wrote a book about it. So that gave a wider sense of why I was doing what I was doing. But it was allowed for people to laugh. And in order to signal that very strongly, I made my, I think you call them jockey shorts, is that what you call them?
Right.
Out of nettle, so stinging nettles. But they didn't sting, but once you've taken the fiber off the plant, it doesn't sting. But it was in order to be able to say, I did that, and then people can go, wow, he's either crazy or it's really a good idea, and they find out more. And
for both. For many people, indifference really seems to reign. Here in America, low voter turnout, celebrity worship, and bland consumerism. Most people just don't really care that much.
I think what underlies that, my strong feeling is that people don't realize that everything that they do is changing the world. And when people don't realize that, they just drift in a kind of a state of unconsciousness about what they're doing. And once you really notice that what you're doing is having an effect on the world, then you are more likely to think, well, hang on, I don't really like that effect. I'd like to try for this one. And so sometimes when I say that to people, they look a bit blank, like, what do you mean I'm changing the world? So I should tell you a tiny little kind of context. For a long time, we, certainly in the UK, have been taught history as if it's all about great men. And I mean men because it's very unusual for it to be about great women. And so those of us who don't think of ourselves as great men think that it's nothing to do with us. But then along came, among other people, the Russian novelist Tolstoy, who pointed out that history is really the accumulated sum total of an infinitely large number of infinitesimally small things that we do and don't do every day. So, you know, you are doing this instead of that, and that's your choice. So to take that to a ridiculous extreme, at night time you are not feeding the homeless but having a sleep, and that's your choice. I mean, we all need to sleep, but you are doing that. And once you start noticing what you're doing, so for example, you're contributing to a world where everyone's indifferent to politics and reading about celebrities, then you can kind of think, is that really what I want to be doing?
So the
very empowering.
Go ahead.
It's a very empowering thing, actually, to notice your effect.
So if you feel like you want to make a difference, because there probably are many people that say, I want to make a difference. I mean, we hear about so much going on in the world. How do we begin? Do we begin with our passions, things we're passionate about?
I think that's always a good idea, because if you aim to do something you're not really interested in, you probably won't persist. And so what that calls for is a really, really honest scrutiny of what really, really interests you. And there's a very strong sense in all of us, rather guiltily, to assume that we ought to be fixing hunger in Africa or something that's like a really big deal with capital B, capital D, end poverty or something like that. But actually, some of us, what we feel called to do is to set up a circus or plant some more flowers. And, you know, it would be a really dreary world if everyone was focused on fixing poverty and no one was doing any gardening. Everyone's got their own thing that they can contribute. So think what it is you really, really want to do and aim for that and make it slightly audacious. And then you're more likely, you know, you may not get to that end point, but you'll do something on the way there that will be pretty good.
So you recommend asking the question, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail, as if success was magically guaranteed? But isn't that a little unrealistic to think that way?
If you're asking the question in a playful way, in order to identify what it is you really care about, then it gives you something to aim at, and then you move towards it. So if your aim is to have flowers in every window, in every street, in every city, that might be a kind of a big aim for, but you might actually end up with flowers in every window in your street, and other people might pick up and copy it. So you're setting yourself a direction. It doesn't have to be, if you get too bogged down on whether it's realistic or not, that's a bit like asking yourself, why haven't you already arrived at the beginning of a very long trip?
Touch on where civil disobedience can come in and the ethics of...
I think no one has any doubt these days. I would imagine not very many people have any doubt that it was the right thing to stand up against the Nazi regime, for example. So the idea that we should always observe every rule and regulation is clearly not one that anyone really holds true. So then it always has to come down to a personal decision. Do you think, in this case, that the law or the regulation or the social norm is right or is it not right? And once you've confronted the question, you ask yourself, do I care enough about this to break it? Do I want to do something differently? And if you decide on balance that it's probably the right regulation, you don't like it much, then stop complaining about it. You've made that decision.
How do you feel about Snowden and the NSA? The leaks.
Crumbs. That's a really big subject. That I think if he's doing what he thinks is right, then that's definitely the right thing for him to do. I mean, that sounds like an evasion. I don't want to write a book that says I know what the right things are to do in order to change the world in a good way. What I really, really strongly and passionately believe is that people must take control of their own responsibility and decide what they think is right. I mean, of course, like a human being, any human being, I have my own kind of view on what political things I might approve of and what are the sort of artistic movements that I like most and so on. But I really, really don't want to eliminate the parties that I don't agree with or the artists whose work isn't exactly my cup of tea.
Does it require that we be leaders and not followers, or just that, as you said, we just take responsibility for our share of the world around us?
Again, I think it's quite a nice thing to avoid words like should and must and require. And what I like to hold in mind is that life is a little bit like being in a jazz band. If you want, sometimes you can be the soloist, but at other times, just keep in the background and keep the rhythm, so someone else can do that. So the idea that we should be leaders, it could be really exhausting. And it's also kind of imposing on everyone else. So aim for the thing that you want to do, and sometimes that will mean just helping out. Someone else in your street has the wonderful dream of putting flowers in every window. So just do your window and let them take care of the big picture.
And when you say we all make history all the time, you're saying that every one of our actions is a decision and we're making history whether we like it or not?
Yeah, there's an analogy I was given by an Oscar-winning British actor, Jonathan Pryce. He talked about the power of a powerful king on the stage. He asked me, what does the powerful king on the stage look like? And I said things like, well, he's got a really big crown, or the throne is covered in gold. That just tells you that it's the king. What makes that powerful king on the stage look powerful is the fact that everyone else on the stage is flat on their face before him. If one of them, just one of them, gets up and turns their back and starts playing the trumpet or smoking a cigarette or having a sleep, then the same king, without doing anything differently at all, looks a lot less powerful. And that one person's example might inspire other people to do something similar. Now, it's never going to be easy to take that brave step, but it does show that you have the capacity to change the status quo. If you think about the status quo as that powerful king on the stage, are you really willing to continue to bow down on your face before it, or do you want to get up and do something better instead?
We're speaking with John Paul Flintoff. He's a broadcaster, journalist, and author, and the name of his book is How to Change the World. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls. Stay with us.
And we return, Tuesday afternoon edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we rejoin John Paul Flintoff. He's joining us from London. If you'd like to phone in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And also you can tweet us, that's at Topical Currents. Perhaps as a listener, if given one choice, what would you choose to change in the world? Not for your self, but for humanity or your community. Give us a call, 1-800-743-9576.
So, John Paul, you say we should focus on the process and not the goal. So tell us about that. I mean, isn't the goal important in something like this?
Well, the goal is absolutely important, but what we often forget is that process is equally important. And sometimes focusing on the goal can be destabilizing and intimidating. So I sometimes, when I'm doing classes here in London, I ask people to draw someone, and I point out the drawing can be, you know, the finished artifact, or it can be the process of the drawing. And no one seems to have really previously thought about the fact that the process itself can be enjoyable. So you, once you start enjoying the process, you fall in love with the small steps, and each small step is like a mini victory. It gives you slightly more courage to do the next step. And if we think that we have to do this amazing, awesome thing straight away from where we stand, when we've not really achieved much and we have little self-confidence, we really need those small steps. So it's a different way of thinking. If you think about a static, finished object that's kind of over there, you're never going to get anywhere near it because you're not making it. But if you think about your goal and your mission instead as not as a final destination, but as like a piece of music, you can enjoy it already because it's already started.
John Paul Flintoff, tell us the story of the Berlin Wall. In your book, you relate that it really wasn't governments that brought it down, but just a mass of people showing up and making the governments realize that it was fruitless to keep that wall up.
Yeah, I mean, it really hit home for me when the anniversary came up, that lots of world leaders went to Berlin to kind of bask in the wonderful glory of having the wall come down. But it wasn't about any particular individual political leader, really. It was an enormous number of people inspired by what had happened in the weeks beforehand in neighboring countries who just turned up at the wall. And eventually, when there are that many people, the military just didn't want to kill them all. I mean, it just was not a good idea. And you see that same thing happening in many other places. In Belgrade, when nearly the whole population of Serbia decided to come to the capital city, the military had been told to block the city so that that couldn't happen and to protect the Milosevic regime. But in fact, what happened was there are so many people, the military really didn't want to kill all their brothers and fathers and sisters and daughters and mothers. And so when they were told they weren't allowed to move their vehicles from the freeway, the people said, is it okay if we drive around your vehicles? And the soldiers said, yes, we think that would probably be okay. So at some point, the sheer courage and daring of aiming for something is what makes everyone else go, yeah, I wouldn't be part of that thing.
you mentioned that there are three types of actions we can take once we decide that we want to affect a change. Can you explain them?
Yes, sure. This insight comes from the absolutely brilliant American academic Gene Sharp. And he pointed out that when it comes to change, one of the key ones is just to draw attention to what needs to be done or what the problem is. And it is very important to look at the problem. People sometimes shy away from that, like as if looking at a problem is being gloomy or negative and bad. But if you don't really understand what the problem is, how can you hope to fix it? So at the beginning, you know, really, really try to understand what is the problem. Then think about the solution. And what that will involve is kind of name-calling and putting a label on it and saying, you know, this needs to be done. And this is what, you know, the biblical prophets did. They named the problem. And there are so many different ways in which we can do that. We can do it entertainingly. We can do it tragically. We can do it seemingly with ease on Facebook or Twitter. Or we could do it. The same thing can be a very dangerous step in a regime where they keep an eye on the kind of things you do on social media. So it's neither easy nor hard. It all depends on your context.
Right.
So sometimes in an abusive family, just naming what's going on is a very dangerous and scary thing to do. But that's one step, is naming the problem. The second type of action is having nothing to do with the thing that you don't like. Avoidance. That obviously includes boycotting someone or a regime or a shop, a store, when you don't like something. And the third form of action is setting up a better alternative. Now, that could mean, like the French government in exile in the Second World War, you being an alternative government. Or it could mean just something quite small. It could mean building something that doesn't exist yet. So, like, the Boy Scout movement was set up originally because the British man who founded it thought there weren't very good recruits in the British Army. They weren't strong enough. So that's a very particular, narrow, militaristic, nationalistic, regional reason for setting it up. But it ended up being this wonderful movement that does all sorts of other things in many other countries. So just creating something that wasn't there previously, that's the third type.
How about you're determined to make a change, even a small change, but maybe not thinking it through all the way, and there's a possibility you might do more harm than good?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's a really important point. If you're doing it in good faith and you really think it's the right thing to do, I think it is the right thing to do. Time will, I'm sure, show that your actions have negative effects on someone either far away in time or maybe someone far away from you physically. You just can't know what the long-term and distant implications are of the things that you do. But you will have an effect. And if you're doing it in good faith, then I think you can forgive yourself. You can't avoid having an effect, as I already said. I mean, if you think about the financial crisis, that came about because some people, probably with quite good motives, invented new financial products that were going to make the market faster. You think about the way that the world population has exploded. That's partly because of the way in which well-meaning scientists invented ways of growing more agricultural produce, so the population was allowed to explode. Is that a bad thing they did, to allow more people to be alive? And if one day the population contracts again, do we blame them for creating more abundant food? It's a really hard one. Maybe the best thing is not to go around pointing the finger of blame, but do what you think is right and pursue it. And really keep on asking, is this what needs to be done?
Let's take a phone call or two. We've got Peter. He's in Coral Gables. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hello. My goal is to establish a national policy that the left-hand lane is a passing lane, not a speed lane, to educate the theory of it and to subsequently enforce the laws established. Thank you.
Okay. There you go.
To establish.
How about in the book you talk about Mother Teresa? And she says that she's not responsible for the masses, just an individual. So you should maybe keep your change small in scope.
I think it is really important. She said that she didn't sort of look after thousands of people at once. She did one after another. And it is, again, it's so easy to freeze ourselves with fear when we think about the magnitude of what we would like to do. If you concentrate on the process and do the right thing as much as you can as you're going along. That allows you to get closer to the big picture. But another thing that I love about what she said is that I really do believe very strongly that one of the most important ways in which we can be an effective and wonderful change in the world is just in our own small circle, and to make all relationships between individual beings more satisfying and happier. If you aim to fix everything for people in Africa where you don't even live, or to do things that are miles away, then kind of what are you doing about the people around you? I mean, we all know stories about great activists who caused unhappiness because they neglect the world under their feet.
Right.
And we go to another caller. This is Vern.
Yes?
Vern of Miami Beach. Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, John Paul. I wanted to ask you about vision. You know, I have this thing that I get every once in a while. It's like a spiritual vision. Can you comment on that?
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about it?
We're short on time. Go ahead.
It's almost like, you know, it's like a spiritual vision. It's I'll give you an example. Okay, I'm listening to you today. I have this project that I actually did. It's marble sculptures. You know, right? Mm-hmm. I'm creating marble sculptures with robots, and how I did that was all of a sudden at one point I got this vision, you know, to do it, and I did exactly what you're talking about, one step at a time.
You had the idea where you wanted to go, and you followed it a step at a time.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thanks for calling, Vern. We appreciate it. And good luck with those statues.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess if we follow our dreams and our passions and we take small steps, it's not impossible to change our world around us.
I think it's impossible not to change it. But don't get carried away and think that everything is going to go your way. And that's quite a nice thing to keep in mind. I mean, don't we want to allow other people to have some effect too? So, you know, aim for what you can. Be encouraged by what you're doing. And allow other people to pick up on some of that energy and do what they want to do.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with journalist and author John Paul Flintoff. We've been talking about his book, How to Change the World. He joined us from London. Have a good evening, John Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez, up next.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Deborah Dean's new novel, The Mirrored World, tells the story of an 18th century saint. Her rejection of materialism brought her into conflict with the court of the Empress Catherine the Great. Saint Xenia was born into nobility, but after her husband died, she gave away all of her possessions. She dedicated her life to helping the poor. In her new novel, Deborah Dean poses the question, was Xenia driven by religious fervor or grief-induced madness? Dean, a creative writing professor at Florida International University, invites us to come up with our own answer. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Dean. He began by asking her if sainthood and insanity go hand in hand.
I think you could make an argument for that. The idea, if you think about what leads one to being a saint, it really is acting against your own self-interest. And it's stepping outside the norms of society. It's interesting, too, because in Russia, there's not the same ideas that we have about insanity. In fact, it really wasn't even a term that anyone would have understood in Russia at the time in the 18th century. You're looking at what norms are, and where insanity is just something past, you know, the on the outside ranges. And people define it differently. You might think it's not a cultural thing, but it really is. And so in Russia, they're much more tolerant of people outside of the norms, even now, and certainly in the time in the 18th century when my novel is set.
Well, your novel tells the story of a saint. I'm trying to pronounce your name correctly.
Xenia.
Xenia. Okay, Xenia. And she's a little-known figure. I'd never heard of her before.
You wouldn't have heard of her unless you were Russian Orthodox.
Exactly. And you do a very good job of recreating 18th century Russian society.
Thank you.
That was a period of transition, wasn't it?
It was very much a period of transition. I used to think the 18th century was like the boring century.
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all. No. It's and in Russia, it's really interesting because the country is sort of being dragged onto the European stage. And first Peter the Great and then his daughter Elizaveta and then famously Catherine the Great were pushing the Russian people to become more European. And so for this period of the novel, the first half of the 18th century on forward, it's almost like the culture is really schizophrenic. They speak Russian at home, but they speak French when they're out in the court. And they dress like Russians, and they have, at home, they dress like Europeans when they're out in the world. And the culture maintains the old ways and the old superstitions and beliefs, but there's also reasoning, the coming in. Voltaire was greatly admired by Catherine the Great. So I think Russians really were sort of tipped one way or the other. They weren't quite sure what to do. And so it's a very self-conscious, highly self-conscious society.
But beneath it all, there was still that barbarity, that savagery.
Yeah. What Dostoevsky talks about, the Russian people being half saint, half savage.
Yes, and you show that in the novel. One thing that stood out for me was the Ice Palace. And this was actually something that did take place. You didn't make it up.
No, I did not.
No. But that was something created out of cruelty. What was the? It was a beautiful thing made out of cruelty. What was the Ice Palace?
Well, Empress Anna Ivanovna, who was the first Romanov Empress, she was widowed when she was very young. And one of the results of that is that for the rest of her life, one of her favorite pastimes was arranging marriages for those beneath her. And she had this one advisor who really ticked her off. And in order to get back at him, she stripped him of his title. He was a prince. And she made him her court jester. And then to rub a little more salt in the wound, she arranged a marriage for him to one of her maids, who was a hunchbacked old woman. And she threw a big citywide party and had a parade. And the bride and groom were in an iron cage strapped on the back of an elephant and paraded through the city. And then she had built this little miniature palace on the frozen river, on the Neva in the center of the city. And it resembled a palace, but it was just smaller. And everything in it was made of ice. The whole palace was made of ice, and it was all furnished with ice beds and tableware, everything. And they had a wedding, and this was where the bride and groom were forced to spend the night in the middle of one of the coldest winters on record. So yes, very cruel. Mm. They did actually survive the night, but just barely.
We're speaking with FIU creative writing professor Deborah Dean, whose new novel is entitled The Mirrored World. Why do you call this The Mirrored World?
It was a title that was arrived at after many other iterations. When I'm writing, I usually expect the title to sort of show up about halfway through the writing. And you have a working title. And my working title for this was Exania. And nothing else came to me. And I kept writing and I kept writing. I had a whole list of possible titles and I would work on it sometimes and nothing really stuck. And I got all the way to the end of the novel and I turned it into my editor and I said, what do you think? Can I just call it Exania? And she said, sure. And I said, really? Are you sure? Because I'm going to go out and talk about it and it'll get out on the internet and that'll be it. And she said, no problem. Well, then the marketing department came back to me and they said, absolutely, please do not do this, Deborah. Please don't call it Exania because nobody knows how to pronounce it. And obviously, from a marketing perspective, that's not good.
You'll probably misinterpret it as Xena, Warrior Princess.
Yeah, exactly. So I worked with the publishers, and I I proposed a title and they rejected it. They proposed a title and I rejected it. And finally we came up with this. And it's not exactly on the nose, but there's a lot of mirrors as imagery throughout the novel. And it is in part reflective, excuse the pun, of the society, that this very highly self-conscious society. And then also the idea of the mirrors. A lot of the mirrors in the novel are images that are warped or changed in the reflection. And so the society, the court society, which is highly, wildly extravagant, is also in some ways mirrored by the extreme deprivation and poverty of the other 99% of the culture. And one of the main characters, Xenia, moves from one extreme of the culture to the other.
Because Xenia was born in an upper-class family.
Yes.
And we see her as a child. We first see her as a child. The novel is narrated not by Xenia, but by her cousin.
Right.
Dasha. And we follow her through a rather lengthy life. I think Xenia lives into her 70s or 80s.
Yeah, historically nobody knows quite, but quite long.
Yes. And Dasha and she, again, grew up in this privileged upbringing. And then something happens. And Xenia has what we would call a breakdown. Mm-hmm. But the Russians consider a kind of epiphany, I guess. What happens to Xenia?
Yeah, she's what in Russia is called a holy fool. And that the closest equivalent here would be the Native American shamans. They're people that I think if Xenia were to show up in Miami today, she would probably be put on meds, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and put on meds.
Sure,
but
yeah.
But in old Russia, these people were they were revered. And the thinking went like this, that all of us are created equal by God. And so people that have very visible defects must also have compensating hidden gifts. And so they would look at people that would be shunned in Europe, and they looked to them for wisdom. And so the holy fools were credited with healing and with prophecy, and the czars all had holy fools in their courts, people to whom they listened and obeyed.
How is Xenia a holy fool? Because I know that what I'm trying to get at is the triggering event is the death of her husband.
Right.
And then after her husband dies, how does she transform?
In some of the legends, it's just, it's said that she went mad with grief. And she began to give away all of her worldly possessions and divest herself of everything. And then she disappeared. And there's no record of her for 6 or 7 years. And when she reappears, she was living on the streets in the worst slum in St. Petersburg. And she was dressed in the rags of her husband's military uniform and would only answer to his name. And people started crediting her with miracles. And she became very popular with the people, to the point that she was regarded as a bit of a threat to the establishment and to the court.
Why was she a threat?
Well, historically at this point, Catherine the Great was very much a believer in these ideas of equality to a point. But then when the French Revolution came along, she had second thoughts. And so she became a little bit paranoid. Anybody that she thought might be gathering the people together were regarded as a bit threatening.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Deborah Dean. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is FIU creative writing professor Deborah Dean, whose new novel, The Mirrored World, tells the story of an 18th century Russian saint. This is a work of historical fiction. In the past, historical fiction has had a rather, shall we say, checkered reputation.
Yes.
This has changed recently in the last 20 or 30 years. There's been quite a large number of critically acclaimed works of historical fiction. Thomas Mallon is a historical novelist, and he once said that when we're dealing with historical novel, historical fiction, you must always remember that nouns trump adjectives, that it's the noun you should always keep in mind, not the adjective. And so when you're writing your novels, your historical novels, how much of it is dependent on the history and how much of it is dependent on the imagination?
Well, I hew very closely to what really happened, in part because I think a lot of people, wisely or not, read historical fiction as though it is all true. And when I was writing my first novel, The Madonnas of Leningrad, and that was set during the Siege of Leningrad in 1941, it was very important to me to tell the truth of that story, in part because it's not that far in the past. There were people still alive when I was writing this novel that had gone through this experience. So I also knew I could get called out if I got anything wrong. And so I'm very careful to do the research and make sure that I get it right. And then I don't contravene anything that's known. But that usually leaves large gaps. And particularly with this novel, with The Mirrored World, you can find out just about anything you want to know about the 18th century court. But as soon as you step outside of the court, the historical records are not there, because 18th century Russia was largely pre-literate. So the kinds of things that you need to know as a novelist, like what people ate, what they thought, what they did during the day, you get those kinds of things from letters and journals. And if you have a pre-literate society, you don't have those records. So there was lots of room for me to make things up.
Well, you mentioned the Madonnas of Leningrad.
Mm-hmm.
That was your first novel.
Yes.
And it's a story of a woman, and it's actually two sides of this woman. One when she's younger, the other when she's older. We see her in around the 2000s or the 1990s,
yeah.
And she's old and suffering from Alzheimer's. And then because her disease is eating up her present, she only has her past to rely on. And she looks back at the time when she was a guide at the Hermitage Museum during the Siege of Leningrad. But what amazes me is for that novel and this novel, you don't speak Russian, do you?
No, I don't. No, there's no logical reason for me to have written two novels set in Russia.
In fact, you had never even visited Russia by the time you were working on the first novel.
No. My husband says I was Russian in a former life, and that's the best explanation I can come up with. I am fascinated by Russia, but I came to the Madonnas of Leningrad, and I wrote the Madonnas of Leningrad in part inspired by my own ignorance, because I knew so little. And as creative writing teachers, we're often encouraging students with that cliche of write what you know. And there's, you know, it's good advice, because it's much easier to write what you know. It's harder to invent or create a world that's not yours and make it true. But I'm much more interested in what I don't know. And with Madonnas of Leningrad, this is my pitch for public television. I watched PBS one night, and there was a 3-part special on the Hermitage Museum. And part two was on the siege. And I was fascinated, because I had never even heard of the Siege of Leningrad. And I thought, how is this possible that over a million people could die, civilians? And I would never even heard of it. And so I started researching from there. My curiosity just took me further and further into the story. And then something grabs a hold of you. And I really didn't want to write a novel set in Russia, because I knew how difficult it would be. But I do think your stories choose you rather than the other way around. The thing I knew about the second novel was that I didn't know what I was going to write, but I knew it wasn't going to be set in Russia. And there I went again.
Well, we're speaking with FIU creative writing professor Deborah Dean, whose new novel is entitled The Mirrored World. Just to stay on Madonna's for a second, years ago I saw this film called Russian Ark, which is
a
fictional movie, which I think is about the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And you, in an interview, mentioned that you saw a website that helped you on the Hermitage, where you saw every room.
Yeah, well, it's the Hermitage website.
It's the Hermitage website.
Yeah, it's a fabulous website. Uh-huh.
And it shows you every room.
You can go, well, there's maps, because the museum is enormous. And there's maps of the museum, and you can click on a room, and it will open up scrolling video of the room. And so you can mouse around the room, and you can slow it down and go in and look more closely at something and speed it up. And then they also have lifetime cameras mounted on the roof of the museum, so you can see the city. And you can spend hundreds and hundreds of hours on that website. And I think well-spent hours. It's a really amazing website.
And it amazes me because the story that you tell in that novel, which is true, about how they evacuated all the artworks from the museum, and yet the staff stayed there. They stayed around, 2,000 people?
Something like that, yeah.
They just lived in the museum.
They lived in the basement.
In the basement.
Yeah, there were bomb shelters underneath the museum. And so what happened is when the Germans first attacked, they started packing up the contents of the museum. And at the time, that was 1.2 million items of art. And they spent several weeks round the clock packing these things up. And they were packed and they were put on trains and shipped out of the city to a secret location so that if Hitler got through the lines, he wouldn't get the art. So they emptied out the museum, but they left the empty frames hanging on the walls as a pledge that the art would come back. And then the staff members, the same people that had packed all of this art up, they moved into the basements because the Nazis were doing what they had done in London, which the Blitz. Every night, 7 o'clock, they would come in and they would start bombing. So these staff members and their families and the scholars, the museums are a little bit different there than they are here. So there were a lot of scientists and archaeologists, people other than just curators and artists. They were all living in the basements and they lived there for the first winter.
Amazing. In The Mirrored World, it's narrated, as I said earlier, by Dasha, Xenia's cousin. And in your first novel, The Madonna's Leningrad, it's a third-person point of view. Is this because both those characters, Marina in The Madonna's Leningrad and Xenia, they really can't tell their own story?
Yeah.
Because Xenia is, I think, crazy, and Marina is losing it. So you have to distance yourself from these protagonists.
It's a pull. With Madonna's of Leningrad, I wanted to tell the story through the consciousness of somebody with Alzheimer's, because I think if you have a loved one that has Alzheimer's or dementia, there's really a compelling draw to want to know what that experience is like from the inside. And so I tried to tell the story in a way through Marina's point of view, but you can't do it entirely through the point of view of somebody that is losing their memory. So it's third person, but it's a close third person, so it goes in and out of her consciousness. And the same thing was true with Xenia. I really didn't feel like I could inhabit the mind of a holy fool. And so I gave myself a narrator who is in some ways my alter ego and is the person who is somebody who is in love, loves the saint. And the question for me as I was writing the novel is, what would that be like if somebody that you loved started making these choices or doing these things that other people might say, oh, she's a saint, but I'm not so sure if there's such a thing. If they say there's no man is a prophet in his own country, and I'm not sure any woman is a saint in her own family.
Well, she may be your alter ego, but she marries a castrati.
Yeah, so it's not me.
That's not you.
No.
I don't know what your marriage is like. But and but that character is fascinating. the eunuch, the Francesco
Gaspari.
What's he like? Tell us about that, because he's one of the characters I really was attracted to in this novel.
Yeah, this is based again on an historical truth that the empresses imported culture from Europe, and so they had French chefs and German tutors, and they had Italian architects, and they had the castrati, and at the time that they were the rock stars in Europe, and they went all over the place, and in Russia they could afford them. So Gaspari is Italian. He comes in. There's other castrati there as well, and he's like a rock star, but he's also somebody who they swoon over him when he's on stage, but he is also pariah socially.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Deborah Dean.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more info, book links, and discussions at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board. Thursday, we begin with Augustine Burroughs, the noted author of This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's annual Mango Madness program with Fairchild's Dr. Richard Campbell. 'Tis the mango season. To the calendar, on this day in 1942, 71 years ago, the birth of Sir Paul McCartney in Liverpool. Guinness lists him as the most successful musician and composer in popular music history. His Yesterday composition is the most frequently covered song. And on this day in 1948, 65 years ago, Columbia Records reveals its new long-playing 33 and a third phonograph record. The album is born. Remember Record Changers? Styli? One more on this day, 1989, 24 years ago, the death of muckraking journalist and columnist I.F. Izzy Stone at age 81. An early critic of the Vietnam War, he was investigated for decades by the FBI and CIA. And we leave with this thought from Izzy Stone, quote, "Every emancipation has in it the seeds of a new slavery, and every truth easily becomes a lie." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.